The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
Marvelous!
This is Talk Is Jericho.
Talk Is Jericho,
starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. I am Chris Jericho. Welcome to the show. Good to have you back, all my wonderful, fine, beautiful, sexy, sassy Jerichoholics. Thank you for joining me, as always. Ready for a good show today. M Shadows Revenge Sevenfold is here. Not only a number one, critically acclaimed rock and roll singer in one of the biggest bands in the world today, but also a huge, avowed gamer. He loves the video games and is even creating one called Hail to the King Deathbat. Can't wait to play it. Feeling good. Had a good breakfast today. Eggs and bacon and fruit, all part of the caveman diet, also known as the paleo diet. I've been on the caveman diet for, I don't know, a couple years now, 2.5 years or so, to the point where it's not a diet. It's my diet. It's all I ever eat. And people say, well, what exactly is the caveman diet? Well, the caveman diet is all meat, chicken, fish, vegetables, lots of vegetables, fruit, but nothing citrusy, like just all berries, raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, goozleberries, goozleberry, goozleberry, goozleberry pie, eggs, you know, stuff like that. Bacon in the morning, which gives you your fat. I know cavemen didn't have bacon. They had pork, I guess, but, you know, bacon. But you got to have some kind of fat in your diet, so that's where the bacon comes in. Don't ask me. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm just doing what they told me. And water, drinking nothing but water. And if I want to have a little drinky-winky, I have Grey Goose and water, or Grey Goose and ice, more specifically, to where if you drink Grey Goose and ice, you will never get a hangover. Yeah, true story. I know people say, Chris, come on. I'm telling you, if you drink nothing but Grey Goose, high-end vodka, top-shelf vodka and ice, you will never get a hangover. And people say, how is that possible? I'll tell you how it's possible. Because, you know, when you drink, there's always a lot of calories and sugar in the mix. If you have vodka and orange juice, when I was early teens, mid-teens, I always thought it'd be cool to drink vodka and orange juice, because that's how Paul Stanley says it on Alive. Drink vodka and orange juice. Oh, yeah. So I called them Paul Stanleys. So if you're going to drink a Paul Stanley, it's very tasty, but there's a lot of sugar and a lot of calories in the orange juice. And that's kind of what gets you hungover, is the sugar. You're drinking, you know, rum and coke, or, you know, gin and tonic, all that stuff that has a lot of sugar in it. Bad for you. And brown alcohol, bad for you, a lot of calories, a lot of sugar. Like, I used to drink a lot of Crown Royal. Horrible choice. Used to make me go nuts pulling fire alarms and doing all this horrible, terrible things. Vodka, not like that. Clear, low calorie. I think there's actually even protein in vodka, if you can buy that. But if you drink the vodka and just ice, no calories and no sugars – and also you're hydrating yourself the whole time, which they say if you're going to go drink before you go to bed, drink a big glass of water. I don't have to do that because I'm drinking water the whole time. You get it? So I'm doing two things at once, killing two birds at one stone. And I think cavemen had vodka, didn't they? I'm sure they must have. And I got into the caveman diet when I went to Metallica 30 anniversary back in 2011 in San Francisco at the Fillmore. And I saw this guy who was walking over to me that looks like kind of like a total James Hetfield wannabe. Like, oh, this guy's like super skinny, but he looks kind of like James. And then I realized it was James. And I had just seen him about 4 months earlier, and he was getting kind of hefty. And he had lost all this weight, I guess probably for the 30th anniversary. He wanted to look his best, and boy, did he ever. And I was like, James, what did you do? And he said, I got on the caveman diet. Well, what's the caveman diet? And he told me. So I was thinking to myself, I'll give it a try, see what happens. And bingo bammo, lost like 10 pounds in like a month. It was amazing. And have never stopped using it since. So if you saw me when I came back to the WWE in 2012 in like January and I was super shredded, not that I'm not now. Yeah, boy. That's the reason why, because I was doing yoga, DDP yoga, and having the caveman diet. I saw Hetfield later on that year when we played at Download 2012. And I was asking him how his caveman diet was going, and we were discussing cholesterol levels and Synthroid pills. And I was like, you know, this is not the conversation I would imagine having with the mighty James Hetfield when I was like 15 years old. You know, like you'd think it'd be about rock and roll and about metal and about drinking and about chicks. No. We're talking about cholesterol levels, Synthroid. And how's your diet, eh? How's your diet, mate? Ooh, yeah. Yeah. My diet's fine. So if you're looking for a way to lose some weight, go on the caveman diet. But don't mess around. Like a lot of people are like, well, I like to eat bread, or the caveman diet's got no bread, no carbs, no processed foods, no sugars, none of that stuff. It's all like whole foods. Like if you go to Whole Foods and shop, you can buy stuff for the caveman diet. But you can't, like I said, you can't vary it where people want to make like amends, or they want to make updates and changes. You can't do it. You're either in or you're out. And if you ain't in, then you must be out. So if you want to lose some weight, go on the caveman diet. That's not even an advertisement. I don't even know if it's the official name. I think it's the Paleo diet, like I said. So go online, look up caveman diet, Paleo diet, and follow it. And the best part of all was when I said to James, he's like, yeah, the caveman diet, and he's telling me about it. I was like, well, didn't cavemen die like before they're even 30? He goes, yeah, well, that's because the dinosaurs ate them. Ba-boom, boom, bam. Yeah. M Shadows is on the line, but first, I gotta say thanks to the sponsors who make this show possible every week.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
On the line from Avenged Sevenfold, one of the number one rock and roll heavy metal bands in the entire planet, M Shadows is here. How you doing, man?
What's up, man? I'm doing good.
Good. It's good to have you on. It's been a while since we had a time to chat. You've been pretty busy over the last, basically over the last year, writing, recording, touring on Hail to the King, the number one album on Billboard in August of 2013. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot, man. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Testament to the fans for sure. Going out there and picking it up, especially this day and age. So it was a very, very nice, pleasant surprise.
Well, it's funny too. We were just talking about kids and how when you have one kid, you know when it's coming. But then when you have a second one, you have one kid, you don't really know what's coming. But you have your second one, and you kind of like, or you know what's happening. This is your second number one record. Was it like no big deal this time?
No, it wasn't that it was no big deal. But the first one is definitely the first one's surreal. The second one, we were in a little bit different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that we were expecting it, but we were really determined to get out and tour. We were going, dealing with a lot of production issues and things we wanted to do this time around. So we were just in more of a work mode. Mm-hmm. So when it happened, it kind of came and passed. And we were also doing dates, kind of jumping on and off of Upwork last year, mm-hmm. doing off days. And so, you know, when you're out there, like, flying out to shows and doing different things, there wasn't really time to hang out and party and celebrate. It was more of a, mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of working and playing shows. So it's different this time, you know? It's always different.
Well, and the thing is, too, though, I mean, you guys took a chance. I mean, we've talked about this in the past, but, I mean, you guys basically changed not your style, because you're still Avenged Sevenfold, but you changed your mindset of how you wrote songs on Hail to the King, going for the more groove, kind of the more punchier, more to the point type songs. Were you kind of, I don't think nervous is the word, but were you curious as to how the fans were going to react?
I usually have a pretty good idea how they're going to react.
Yeah.
You know, every record we get pretty much the same thing. A lot of people like it. A lot of people don't like it. And, you know, if you actually go and look at, you know, what people say about all of our records, there's a lot of adamant people that every one of our records is our best record,
mm-hmm.
and the other ones suck, you know, like, so it's one of those things where I know that's probably going to be the case with Hail to the King. I know there's going to be a lot of people that don't like it, a lot of people that do like it. And then I know when we put out the next record, a lot of people will say, this isn't as good as Hail to the King. And then a lot of people will say, I'm glad that they didn't put out another record like Hail to the King. So for us, we're kind of in that realm where, you know, we get a lot of complainers about whatever we put out. So I knew exactly what we were getting ourselves into. I don't really know any other way to do it, though. You know, we like to put out different records, and the next record I'm sure will be as different to Hail to the King as Hail to the King is to anything else we've already put
right.
out. So, you know, it's exciting. That's what I think is fun about it. I like putting stuff out and seeing the reaction.
Well, and that's one thing about being a musician, too. It's fun and necessary to change your style and change how you write, because if not, it gets very boring. I mean, there's only so many AC/DCs and Slayers in the world that can do kind of the same album over and over again. You guys took a chance, but in a good way. I almost hate to use the word matured as musicians, if that's even the case, but definitely took a right turn in the direction that you've been heading for stylistically.
Yeah, totally. And you know what? I hope that we don't get too mature. You know, I hope that we make another immature record eventually. You know, like, I want to keep it fresh. I don't want to go too far down the road where it just gets more song-oriented, because I think there is a place to write, you know, some more progressive tunes. And, you know, like, on this record, we cut out all the neoclassical stuff and all the, like, melodic minor stuff. And we used a lot more blues oriented, you know, scales and whatnot. But, you know, I know there's room for the other stuff on another record, you know, and
right.
You know, so it'll be fun to explore that sometime. I think by doing a record the way we did it with Hail to the King, it gave us a lot of ammunition maybe for the next one at some point. So I just like making music, man. I don't know. It is interesting, though. I mean, you know, you put out a record and you get to see everyone, you know, praise it and tear it down, and it's pretty interesting.
Well, especially if you need to have a thick skin when everybody is a critic, you know, nowadays, especially when it's so easy for somebody to go online and, you know, post an opinion or whatever it is. But I think you knew what you were doing, and you knew you were doing the right thing. And definitely, you know, selling 160,000 records in the first week, I mean, in this day and age, in 2013, 2014, that's amazing. What do you think was the appeal to be able to sell that many actual records in this day and age of downloading?
I really don't know. I think it's because we're young and we have an active fan base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of the older generation, a lot of the older bands that put out great records, I don't know if their fans still go out and buy as many records.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a younger fan base, which we kind of have a mixed fan base, I think, you know, the younger kids still want to go out and buy records and be really active with new music. So I don't know if that will last forever. We're selling tons of records every week or ever, you know, but I think while you have a young fan base, it's definitely possible.
Well, it's interesting too, as well, when you're talking about kind of the stylistic change. I mean, you went to more of the groove blues type, not even blues, more of a groove type vibe, kind of the similar way that Metallica did on the Black Album. And you guys made it to places that you never had been played before with Hail to the King, the song, I know for sure, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the the spectrum of like where they'll play rock music these days isn't very large at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think anywhere that they'll play rock music, they'll play Hail to the King, or they have, which is cool. But yeah, I don't know. It's pretty small. I mean, if you look at the window of, you know, the amount of plays like a pop song, like a real truly pop song gets compared to what even the biggest rock song gets, it's pretty minuscule.
But you were able to at least make it onto like K-Rock and places like that that would never have touched even really heavy metal at all.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was nice to get K-Rock on board because, you know, we're from, you know, pretty much Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't really played us for a while. And, you know, it's just always nice to have some home support. And Hail to the King did well for them. But, you know, you just don't know. I mean, you hear it in between Avicii and 40, and you just don't. And you just don't know if that group of people want to hear Hail to the King when they're listening to, I mean, basically pop music.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. It's like Fall Out Boy and Beyonce and Avenged Sevenfold coming up next.
Yeah, and you know, that's probably why it didn't last that long on there. You know, it was on there for a while. It did well. And I think people that used to listen to K-Rock and that still kind of listen to K-Rock, that, you know, that's their station,
mm-hmm.
they enjoyed it. But I think a lot of the newer K-Rock fans are more of a pop-leaning fan. So who knows if they want to hear, you know, a song about kings and getting your tongue ripped out.
That's great, too. Yeah, that's the first line of the song. Hold your tongue or get it ripped out of your head, I think it is.
Exactly. Yeah,
That's romantic lyrics, man. I mean, you're different now. Mm-hmm. You've got a family. You have to change the way you write your lyrics.
Exactly. I want to be a good role model for my son.
I mean, but how do you feel about it when people say that you're kind of – I mean, obviously, Metallica is still the modern-day Metallica, but when you kind of took – I mean, almost the same way that Metallica – we keep talking about the 91 Black record, Black album. You kind of did the same for that with heavy metal on Hail to the King in certain instances. How do you feel about those comparisons that you're kind of the modern-day Metallica?
I try to ignore it, honestly. I mean, it's flattering, but, you know, with the press and what magazines want to write and what websites want to write, they want to really blow that out of proportion like we're saying it.
Yeah, no.
Not, you know?
Right, right.
And so, obviously, to be compared to who we consider the greatest, it's a complete honor and it's awesome, but I just hate when, you know, people kind of cherry-pick things and cherry-pick quotes, and then all of a sudden we think we're the next Metallica, or we think that we're, mm-hmm. you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. and we don't. We're just, you know, five guys that like to play music and put out records, and we have we're very lucky to have the fan base that we have, and we understand that when you have that, a lot of people want to throw stones.
Yeah.
So we kind of just roll with it. But, you know, it's interesting to see what whole community as a whole has become with the internet and with you know, social media and stuff. It's definitely different. I mean, Chris, I mean, your band and our band are kind of the first, like, the first generation of bands that have to deal with the internet like that. So it's a new beast. So who knows how it's going to treat everybody, but it is what it is, you know. And you know me, I already told you, man, I stopped going on the internet. I can't handle it. It's just like, I just can't do it. So, I mean, I stopped going on months ago, and it makes you a happier person, I'm telling you.
Yeah, for a while there, you were getting kind of mad about some of the things people were saying, and deservedly so. I mean, when you do a record or do anything creative, it is kind of I was the same. I took it personally as a personal insult if someone didn't like something that I did. I mean, even if I go on Twitter and read, you know, about this podcast, someone will say, "Oh, the way your segues into the ads are terrible," or something or other, and you're like, "Oh," but you just got to be thick-skinned, right?
I could do it better.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know.
Well, it's funny because I never really get mad about things people say about me. I get mad when I see things that just aren't true. And, mm-hmm. and it's not even about, you know, just us. You know, like, I remember seeing a thing where there's like 50 comments about how Metallica has completely lost their fan base.
Sure.
And they've turned their back on them. And I'm like, the last time I saw Metallica, there was 60,000 people there.
Yes.
Like, what do you mean? Like
right.
You really feel that everybody feels that way? It's not even close to the case. But you got 50 people on there, like this unibrain, all copying each other's comments saying, you know, yes, Metallica, they're nothing now. You know, like,
yeah.
And it's just pretty crazy to me. It's like, oh, wow, people really believe that.
I think it's funny if you go and we've discussed this, if you go on to like a blabbermouth.net, which is the big heavy metal website, and go to any band, I don't care who it is, go click on any story that's on there and then go to the comments. Like you said, there'll be your 20, 30, 40 people that just hate everything. And I wonder if it's the same people over and over again that don't really care what band it is. They just want to bury everything that they're reading about.
I don't know, man. It is pretty funny, but who knows?
Well, like you said, the bottom line is it's a number one record, huge success. How are the songs going over live? How many songs do you play live from Hail to the King?
They're great, man. I mean, we play about four of them live right now. Mm-hmm. We're going to probably kind of move a couple in and out of rotation just because, you know, we want to try to get through most songs on this record while we're on this cycle.
Right.
But it's a tough thing at this point, you know, like, you know, we get complaints that we play the same stuff, and then we went and you know, changed up the set list a little bit, took out some things that we usually play, and then, you know, immediately the first reviews are, I can't believe they didn't play these songs. And you're just in the situation now where you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. So
right.
You know, right now we play Shepherd of Fire, we play This Means War, we play Hail to the King, we were playing Doing Time and Requiem, probably drop Requiem and bring up Coming Home or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And then get some more old school stuff. I want to start playing some Waking the Fallen stuff. You know, it's 10-year anniversary. It's almost 11 years now since that album came out. And, you know, we're going to try to do, like, for the whole summer doing those European festivals, we want to really have a good mix of all the records, excluding the first one.
Yeah.
But, you know, since Waking the Fallen, we want to kind of have three or four songs off each record be represented this summer.
It's harder and harder, though. I mean, you guys are on your sixth record now, I believe it is. I mean, how do you choose your set list? I mean, it does get hard because you have the songs you have to play. You've got, I mean, you guys have how many, you know, quote unquote rock radio hits do you have? 10, 12, 15 at this point, number one songs.
Yeah,
I mean, how do you choose which ones stay and which ones go? I mean, you'd be up there playing the Springsteen set if your fans had their way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things where you're right. We have to play certain things. But what we're doing now is just kind of what we want to do is throw, you know, a couple, maybe two or three special songs in the set, or things that you don't expect to hear. And then, I mean, the Buried Alive, the Afterlives, the Critical Acclaims, the Beast of the Harlots, Backcountries, I mean, they kind of have to stay. I mean,
right.
People are coming to see those songs, and we don't want to pull the print. You know, Zach went recently and didn't play one song that was even.
Isn't that crazy? How can he do that? I don't get that.
I don't know, man. I mean, he's an artist, man. He can do it however he wants. But
I guess,
you know,
man,
what you're getting. We don't want to be the band that's like too cool to play the songs that people want to hear.
See, that's the thing. You know, I'm going to see Billy Joel in a couple weeks, and I've never seen him. And, you know, he's one of those guys that I want to go to because it's, you know, he's not, I don't know how much longer he's going to be touring. Obviously a classic guy with a million hits, but this tour he's doing deep cuts, which is great if you're a diehard Billy Joel fan. I'm not, I've never seen him. And it kind of bugs me because I got to go listen to all these songs I don't know. And I, you know what I mean? Like, like you said, it's tough. You got to please yourself as an artist. And I get that, you know, but also you got to give the people what they want as well.
Well, and that's also, you know, Billy Joel's been doing it forever. I would be a little annoyed at that, too.
Right.
But, you know, if a band that we were really into was doing that, we might enjoy it. That's the thing. You know, you always have to have a balance where you have to, like, you know, if I looked online all day and saw, you know, the songs that our fans think we want to play, if we went and played that at a festival, people would just be standing there.
Right.
Be like, what is this? You know, and you have to, like, keep a perspective on, you know, there's 400 kids commenting on what they want you to do, but there's 15,000 people here.
Yes.
You know, like the rest of the people probably want to hear some of the bigger songs. So we're going to try to just start, you know, like I said, squeezing in a couple things that are, you know, a little deeper cuts, and we'll see where that goes.
And it's a good problem to have. If you have too many hits, I mean, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, but you definitely get bored playing some of them. You know, you just, I mean, we've been playing Unholy Confessions for so many years.
Right.
It's definitely not a bad problem to have. It's, you know, we should just be grateful that people want to hear our songs.
Well, no, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, and they do want to hear your songs because it's interesting. I know you're kind of on a, I don't know, quote unquote, hiatus / 2 months off. But when Hail came out, you guys went right on the road, right across the States, right across Europe, playing to packed houses pretty much throughout and have a huge production. I mean, I never got a chance to see the shows yet, but just watching what I've seen on YouTube, I mean the production is off the charts. What was your mindset in putting together this amazing stage show that you guys play on the Hail to the King tour?
You know, we just want to trip people out. You know, when they come to the show, we want, like, there to always be things happening. Like, mm-hmm. you're not just standing there bored. I know when I go see shows, I usually watch the first three or four songs, and then I'm kind of looking around going, okay. Like, unless I really, really love a band, I want them to keep my attention a little bit more. And that's just because a lot of the newer bands, they do very, like, video or, you know,
yes.
this or that. I'm just not into that. I'm more into my Maiden shows growing up and mm-hmm. Metallica shows growing up, and there was just a lot going on. And so we try to, you know, pick things out for certain songs and then kind of bring those to life, you know. And Hail to the King, we thought we'd bring out the King, and mm-hmm. then we, you know, things start snowballing where you're just like, okay, well, the King can come out during that song, and can his mm-hmm. head move, and can fire come out of him, and you start going crazy, and then you see the bill, and you're like, okay, let's take off a couple of things.
Right.
And then, and do as much as you can, you know, without completely writing a check at the end of the tour.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fine line because, you know, obviously in the big picture, it's going to pay off. But I'm sure if you're making, you know, $100 a show and you're spending $150, that's not really the way that you can make a living on that.
I know. I have a good group of guys in the band that keep me in check because I'm just like, who cares? Let's go. Come on. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And they have a little bit better sense on their head, you know, like, yeah, come on, let's do something that's reasonable. But the thing is, you get a good production manager, like our production manager, Jordan, I mean, and he can make a show look, you know, like it costs $1 million a night, you know, and it doesn't because he just knows how to put the thing together and how to make it look larger than life, which we're really grateful to have him.
Is the production manager, does he come with you every night, or is it someone that just basically puts together the whole show at the beginning?
No, he comes with us every night. He also puts it together. When we were doing mixing Hail to the King in New York, he would drive down to New York. He's from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just have meetings about the production, and then he would go and work on it and then come back. And so he's like, you know, multi-purpose. He's doing everything for us behind the scenes, but he also comes on the road.
Like, so you sit down with him and discuss the show that you want to do, and then decide how much it's going to cost, and then who makes all this stuff? Like, who makes the giant king behind you, for example?
The giant king was done by a company in L.A. The giant bat we had was made by the same people that made the wall for Roger Waters.
Wow.
So two different companies. Basically, the bat was awesome, and we were going to go back to them for the king, but another company came in and said they wanted to, you know, do it bigger and badder and cheaper, you know? So we gave them a shot at the king, and they nailed it. So, yeah, there's just companies that will, you know, you go out there and get bids on it, pretty much.
So then what happens to the death bat?
Well, he's traveling around the world right now. We just used him in Europe. So we have three major stages that we've built.
Oh.
And basically those just travel around the world. So the gates we had in Sao Paulo recently, or mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Rio.
Yeah.
To do Rock in Rio. It was an easy thing. We could push in front of Maiden set, which was really cool. You know, those gates that catch on fire from the Nightmare album.
Yeah.
And then those are going to go over to Australia for Soundwave. And then the bat is in Europe still, and probably get sent down to South America, and we just kind of put everything on rotation, and then the king will come over to Europe for the summer.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
How many, like, trucks do you have for a tour? You know, you talk about, like, you know, semi-trucks and all that sort of thing. How many crew members do you have?
Oh, I don't know, man. Like, for trucks and stuff, I mean, there's so many things that come out with us. I mean, we bring our own sound, our own monitors, our own mm-hmm. stage, and then you're dealing with all the stuff to support, so there's got to be, I mean, at least 15 trucks out there, but it's not all our stuff. You know, I think our stuff probably fits in three or four trucks. And then, you know, with the crew that we just have, it's probably around 20-some, 25. But there's a lot of crew that work for the companies, like the sound company and the monitor company
sure.
and the lighting company, that I wouldn't say work for us necessarily. They're more out there as contractors for, you know, their individual brands.
Do you know the names of everybody on your crew?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah,
they're
cool.
They're good friends with all of them. Yeah, but there's always random people out there, you know, like I said, that work for the mm-hmm. sound company or whatever, and we usually get to know everybody, but our crew has been the same since day one.
And that's so important, too. That's something a lot of people don't realize, you know, that are music fans, just how important a good crew is and how important it is from a professional standpoint and from a personal standpoint.
Oh, God. It makes your life so much easier, and And it's fun because you want to be able to, you know, on days off, go out to dinner and watch football games and hang out with everybody. And if everyone's miserable, it just, you know, it just makes the whole tour miserable. So, you just want to have friends out there and people that just want to be out there and are having a good time. There's no point of bringing out people that are, you know, get the job done but are miserable. It kind of.
Well, yeah, because it is the extended family. I mean, a lot of people think it's just the five guys in the band or the four guys in the band, but it's basically the whole, whether you have five crew members, 10 crew members, 15. I mean, that everybody has to be cool because all it takes is one guy to be a little bit of a you know, a jerk or whatever, and it kind of throws off the balance.
Yeah, it's true, and we've seen it happen before. You know, you'll be on tour with a lot of bands, or you do some like Uproar or Mayhem, and there's a lot of other bands out there with crews, and there's always, you know, you see a lot of problems, and it's just unfortunate.
Yeah, you know, we just did the tour in Australia with Steel Panther and Buck Cherry, and it was one of the funnest tours, but there was one guy in one of the bands that was just, I don't know what his problem was, and it just threw off the whole, like, anytime that guy came around, it just threw off the whole dynamic, and it's too bad that you have to have that sometimes.
It sucks.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Oh, well.
Well, but that's the way it goes. Whatever. That's why. But no, let's talk about something else too quickly about the Shepherd of Fire video. Just won the Revolver Magazine 2013 Video of the Year. Congratulations. I'm sure you're very excited about that.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that video, though. I remember something you told me about the Backcountry video, how much it cost, and according to the Shepherd of Fire video. Did you tell me the Backcountry video cost $500,000?
Yeah, it got up there. Yeah, it was around $500,000.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah. That was the music industry right when it was starting to decline.
Yeah.
You know, people were still spending money on videos, and I think the industry was still a little bit of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were
denial.
Top selling records. Yeah, it was complete denial. And things like videos still mattered, and that video did matter, to be honest. I mean, that video was, MTV picked it up, and it went straight to TRL and all these crazy weird things, and it was, I guess it was worth it, but those numbers would never even exist nowadays. You know, I was a 3-day shoot in Las Vegas, you know?
Wow.
So
it's just amazing how it has changed, because that was back in 2005, so it wasn't even 10 years ago, like you said, nine years ago.
Record sales, that was just insane. Like, I remember we were like 150 on the charts during Christmas weekend, and it was at 35,000 records a week it was selling, like City of Evil was.
Whoa.
And nowadays, I think, this week, we were number 41 on the charts with 14,000 records.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like no one sells records anymore. It's pretty funny if you look at, not funny, but
yeah,
it's pretty eye-opening if you look at numbers from like 2005, 2004 to, you know, 2013, 14. It's pretty crazy.
Well, it just shows how important touring is now in accordance to before. I think if you look at in the 70s or something, bands would go out for like a 2-week tour just to promote the album. Now the album comes out basically to promote the tour.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, that's what's so good about rock music. I mean, we don't care. You know, like, we want to be on the road, and that's, you know, like, what it's all about. And, you know, live show is the experience. And so it's, it's always been that way for metal bands. That's why they have, like, such a strong fan base. You know, like, the metal bands and the rock bands, they can go all over the world. And, you know, bands like Maiden, who aren't even on the radar to a pop listener in America.
That's right.
They have no idea. They have no idea how big Iron Maiden is, or even Metallica is around the world. You know, they see Metallica at the Honda Center, you know, selling out 15,000, but they don't know that go across to Scandinavia and they're doing 50, 60,000 people a night. It's just insane.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and like you said, on a worldwide basis, I think heavy metal is probably the most healthiest of genres, because I don't think you see that with, you know, we're talking, you mentioned before Avicii and all these bands that are on Hits One or on, you know, K-Rock, and they're probably doing great in the States, but go over to, like you said, Scandinavia, nobody cares. Whereas you get a Metallica, Maiden, an Avenged Sevenfold, your last European tour was a sellout in every country you went to. And that's cool to know that worldwide you guys can go and do that kind of business.
It's awesome. It's definitely awesome.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is Talk is Jericho.
We're back with M Shadows here on Talk is Jericho. M. I can't call you M. I gotta call you Matt. Does anyone call you M?
Some people. That's what happens when you make up a funny name when you're in high school, and then everyone has free reign to tell me whatever they want. I don't even know what to call.
How many people have asked you, what does M stand for?
Not that many. Some have been like Mr. Shadows, Mr. Like, I think it's Mr., you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's your birth name. What was the mindset behind that when you guys created those names back when you were teenagers?
Oh, God. What's the mindset ever when you're a teenager? You know, we just love, I mean, it's just pure excess rock and roll, you know?
Yeah, Guns N' Roses.
Fake names, so we needed fake names. And, you know, we just like the larger than life persona that rock and roll allowed you to do. And we told ourselves that someday it would be normal to be called those names. We're still kind of getting used to it.
I remember, you know? When I first discovered the band, obviously I read about you guys before I actually heard, I think, and I remember just reading Sinister Gates. I'm like, that is the coolest name ever. I just love it. And then you see him, he's like this good looking, super cute guy. I'm like, that can't be Sinister Gates. Sinister Gates got to be like a big, fat, ugly guy.
Totally, right? Or at least have long hair, you know?
Yeah.
He's a crazy guy, so.
Oh, well, obviously, like we talked about, Avenged doing major, major great things. The other thing that I always am interested in talking to you about is a world I don't know a lot about, which is video games. And you're obviously a huge gamer. You love your Call of Duty. As a matter of fact, you have a dressing room where you have a big kind of a road case that it holds your whole TV and video game system in it.
Yeah, Fort Knox, man. After I hit the gym, got to play some video games, and usually after the show, too, if nothing's going on. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
I enjoy video games.
Who's the sad sack that has to carry that around?
Someone on the crew. I don't know. It's just goes in one of the trucks, you know?
I was laughing because a couple times you're having – I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe when we did Uproar or something like that, you had a sore throat or something like that, so you weren't talking, but you still put your Call of Duty microphone on and you were talking into that.
Well, I shouldn't have been. But you know, got to make call outs, man. It's
absolutely.
It's like your guy's getting shot in the back. You got to let him know.
But I mean, you guys have, especially you, have had such a affinity with video games. You even appeared as video game characters in Call of Duty. Was it Black Ops? Which one was it? No.
Yeah, Black Ops 2.
Black Ops 2, that's right. And you played Carry On. You wrote a song for it. So you've always had how did you get involved with the Call of Duty people? Did they know that you were big fans and wanted to get you involved? How did that work?
Yeah, they found out we were fans, and we found out there were some fans at Treyarch, the guys making the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, getting to know Mark, the president over there of Treyarch, he's like Mr. Active Rock. Like, you go in his car and all he's got playing is Octane. You know, he's got, you know, he knows every band.
Right.
Bands that I don't even like. I'm like, who? And he's like, oh, they're on Octane. Their song just got added. And he knows everything about rock. But he's an old school guy as well.
Right.
You know, he grew up on the AC/DCs and, you know, the Sabbath. And so, you know, meeting him, we just hit it off, and he's a Lakers fan, and we just started going to games and hanging out, and all of a sudden it was like, hey, you know, do you guys want to be in the game? Like, just a friendship that came out of going in
there
and testing the game with them and playing it while they were, you know, working on it and giving them my opinion on it. And then it turned into, hey, let's make this a relationship with Avenged and Treyarch. So it was really cool. It was just a really, you know, normal, like, organic.
Yeah, organic, right.
Sort of thing. It wasn't like, you know, label. You know, had like, hey, put our band in the game.
So how did you do the actual, like, I know for when we've done WWE video games in the past, you would sit there and they would do a scan of your face. And then they would also have like some, I don't know, some low-level guys or local guys put on the suits with like the whole, I don't know if it's, they still use the little bulbs or whatever to do the actual moves. Then they would paste my face on the guy doing my move. How was it for you guys to actually do the filming to get into the game?
yeah, we did all that stuff, but we actually got the balls put on us.
So, yeah, boy.
A quote for you. Yeah, this is a quote for you. Yeah, so we got in the little ball suits pretty much and pretty much acted out our scene. And then when it came to the performance part, we all got in them and we played the song in a very scale studio with a bunch of cameras on us, and we tried to pretend like we were playing in front of an audience.
Right.
And they also did, like, you know, the face scans and tattoo scans and pictures, and it was the full deal. It was pretty crazy.
That must have been pretty cool for you.
It was. It was really fun, man. And we were really excited to see how it turned out. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, first came out, a lot of people were like, what the hell? Like, what is this, you know? And then now I see people that just think it's really cool that we got to be in that game. And, you know, it's just an Easter egg at the end of the
Yeah, it's like a little bonus
game.
Thing.
So, yeah, and video games have always done that. They've always put funny little things at the end of games or you know, put little Easter eggs hidden here or there. And we think it was just a really cool one. I mean, obviously we're in it, so we thought it was really cool.
I showed that to my son Ash, who you played Call of Duty with. Actually, he might have even found it himself, and he was all freaking out. Matt's in the game. So he saw you in there.
That's funny.
So let's talk about your game. I mean, you sprung this on me a couple months ago. You sent me the trailer for it, Hail to the King Deathbat. It's basically an Avenged Sevenfold game that you created.
Yeah, you know, it's a mobile game, just so everyone's clear, but it's a very high-end mobile game.
So for your phones, you mean, mobile phones?
It can be played on your phones. We're having a little bit of issues right now because we've packed so much into the game, getting it to work on the phone, but so we're dumbing it down a little bit. We kind of have to, not the story or anything, just kind of the graphics and stuff. You have to really make sure it plays on everything or people are going to want to hang you.
So what do you mean when you say it's a mobile game? Then where does it play?
So it'll play on your iPad, your any sort of tablet.
Gotcha.
So obviously the high-end tablets are, you know, easier to get going in terms of like how we want the game to look. And then when you have to kind of get it ready for like the iPad mini or for certain Android devices or your phone, you know, you kind of have to make the game, you know, run on all those things.
Okay.
You know, so basically that, and there's a bunch of devices out there, like NVIDIA just put out like a mobile gaming device that it's going to work on. We're probably going to put it on Steam, which is a PC platform for people to download games, cheaper games, independent games. So we just basically made our own indie game. So I don't want people to think, oh, they're making a AAA game, because it's not. It's not a $500,000 game. Or, I'm sorry, not a $500 million game.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like putting out Call of Duty or something. This is a game. We wrote the story. We involved Jimmy in it. And with his
character, really?
Plus, they thought it was awesome, yeah.
Oh, that's cool. How do you involve him? Is he a character in the game?
He's a character, yeah, but he helps you along on your journey while you're playing as a deathbat to claim your land back.
Oh, that's great.
So he makes a bunch of appearances, and then there's a way to unlock him and play as him and use his sword as long as you do the correct things. But I don't want to give that away.
Okay.
How to do that. But, you know, so it's a video game. It's kind of like Diablo with more of a story. It's got more of a Zelda feel to it, where there's some puzzles and some, you know, some open world exploring. So it's a cool little game for gamers, you know?
How long does it take to develop a game like that? Like, how long have you been working on this for?
We're going on 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is we have a small team, and we're trying to do everything ourselves so that it's a small group of guys that are working on everything, and the game's getting bigger and bigger as we're going on. It's one of those things where you start off with a small idea, and then, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do that? And now the game has turned into something that's pretty much a beast. And
it's almost like your live show. You keep wanting to make it bigger, and someone has to pull you back.
Totally. And right now, there's no one to pull us back. So. We're just going over the cliff with it. And who knows if anyone will even want to play it? You know, it's just a shot in the dark for us. It's more of just a creative outlet. Video games are something that I grew up on, and our generation grew up on. And I don't expect the older generation to get it, because you know, when we got our Nintendos when we were little kids, you know. That's like our generation.
And right.
I know so many 30, 35-year-olds that all have video game consoles because we grew up on it. And so hopefully people respect it as a game and not just, oh, a band's putting something out or a band's putting their name on something. You know, it's a game that I think will hold up to gamers, not only our fans, but the gamers.
I think people know that. They know that about you, is that you have this other side of you where you really are a hardcore gamer. And I think it's actually really cool that you're doing this. It's I don't think it's healthy, especially in this day and age. You see a lot of people, I mean, Lord knows I do it, to just do the same thing all the time. It's cool and it's awesome to have your number one love, but it's also good to explore something else that you're interested in, and you're creating your whole game of your own. I think that's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, once people pigeonhole you as doing one thing, it's like you can't do anything else.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, they should just stick to music, making music. Hey, quit wasting your time doing that. Write us another record.
Yeah. Go back to wrestling. Come
on. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, it's one of those things where you just got to do what you want. It's funny how everyone's got so many opinions on what you should do.
Right.
And it's just, I've never wasted my time doing that to anybody else. I don't know why they do it to me or you. But at the same time, I think it's just because, you know, it comes out of a good place. You know, they love that you go, that you're a wrestler and they want to see you out there, and fans want another record or they want more live shows. I get it. But I think that this could add another dimension to something that they also might like. So,
well, and it's an Avenged Sevenfold game too, so it's just expanding the whole Avenged Sevenfold empire.
Totally. And I you know, like, that's one of the things that was like kind of we're on the fence about, because we don't want to become, you know, a band that's just doing all these things, but this is something we truly, truly love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that we really want to do, and it's something that I go work on, you know, 6-7 hours a day with these guys.
Wow.
To get it done. And we got to do some cool new music for it. And we got to, you know, to me, it's just another creative outlet, and it tells the story of the Death Bat. And, you know, the one thing that we're probably shooting ourselves in the foot with is that we made it a gamer's game. You know, if we wanted to make money off it, we'd probably make it some game that you charge a little bit of money and your fans can walk through an experience.
Like an app.
You know, but yeah, like, you know, just kind of walk through it. You don't really ever die. It's kind of easy. But this is a gamer. This is going to be tough. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to pick it up and just put it down. Because it's going to be, you know, if you want to play a hard game, like a game like Super Meat Boy or like some of those hard platformers like Contra, you know, it's a tough game. And I want gamers to pick it up and say, I want to beat this game because it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, too, about the music for it. You sent me something yesterday to listen to that just blew me away, actually. You were talking about 8-bit, the sound of video game music. And I bought a stand-up machine, basically because you had one, of all these really cool games from like the 80s. And they always had this really cool music. But it's that music that you hear in a video game. How did you transpose some of these new songs, I think left over from the songwriting sessions from Hail to the King that you didn't use? How did you transpose them into this video game-sounding music?
There's a couple things. Brian got some crazy program where he can basically play any instrument, you know, through this program, and it will transcribe it into musical notes and transcribe it into Pro Tools and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So basically we were writing songs and we just have Brian playing guitar, and we can switch the tones out into, you know, you buy some of those samples of like an 8-bit sampler, you buy like an old Galaga, you know,
right,
fireball sound or something. And you can, like, basically program everything to, you know, the sounds that you want. And then Zach's brother, Matt Baker, he's like a MIDI genius. He's just amazing at what he does. He does music as well. We were just sending him our files and sending him our ideas and our pretty much finished songs. Some were not as finished as we wanted them to be because we had to go on that European tour.
Right.
But we just sent him the melodies, sent him the ideas, sent him what we wanted the sounds to be like, and he would just go off on it. So I feel like, you know, you listen to those sounds, there's a lot of 8-bit in those games that you have at your house, but these have like a real organic like background to them,
mm-hmm,
with like sort of an 8-bit on top of it. So it still feels big, it feels cool, it feels very 2013-14, but it does feel very 1980s as well.
Sure, yeah, it does.
So it's one of those things where we wrote, you know, 7 or actually 8 songs to go along with the game, and then as you play in the game, when you fight bosses, you hear the music, the actual Avenged Sevenfold music of the boss that it correlates to. So when you play the Beast and the Harlot, you fight both of them in Babylon.
Wow.
The music for Beast, the music for Beast and the Harlot actually plays during that. So it's a big mixture of stuff.
So you wrote new songs for the game, or are these kind of leftover tracks that you didn't use for the last record?
A lot of duels and stuff that we didn't use for the record because, you know, like I said, we were doing the more bluesy thing on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of neoclassical, a lot of melodic minor, you know, duels and whatnot. So we used a lot of those things that we didn't feel fit the record, and we used them in the game. So, yeah, there was, like, you know, we got to the point where we needed, like, three more songs, so we had to write three fresh ones as well.
That's amazing, man. And when do you think the game is going to be ready to come out, or do you even know yet?
I think it should be ready. People will be hearing more about it in about 3 months.
Okay.
You know, because right now we have, you know how it is. I mean, I don't know the industry how to release the game as well, so we have a lot of meetings coming up actually this month, and I'm sure people are going to say, okay, well, we need a three-month time span before you get the finished game to you get it out in the market. So I don't know what's going to come, so I think probably 3 to 4 months.
Because you're doing this basically all on your own, and you're going to go take it to companies and sell it to them.
Yeah, well, we already have relationships with iTunes, and then Android will let you put up pretty much anything, like the Google Play Store or whatever. Steam, you can get on Steam, I know that. So we can get it to the places where people can play it. We just want to do a global launch and get everybody on board. And yeah, we have nobody owns any of this. The record label doesn't own any of it. We're paying for it all ourselves. So there's no, like, safety net there, you know, where it's like, okay, this is what you do and this is how it comes out. We're just doing it all ourselves. So I just really don't even, if I give a date, I just really don't know if that's going to happen.
No, but it's great, though, because you also own everything and you're in charge of everything, so you can make it any way you want it.
Exactly.
You mentioned that you had Jimmy in the game, Jimmy Sullivan, Avenged's drummer, that passed away 4 years ago now, a little bit over 4 years ago. How is it now, 4 years after his passing? Is it still tough? Are you able to look on him, think back about him, and just think of all the great stuff? Is it still hard playing gigs without him behind you, or are you getting used to that now?
The gigs, I wouldn't say I'm getting used to it, but this last, the 28th, this last one we just had was a rough one. I don't know why. You know, like,
why is that? In 4 years?
I don't know why it was. Yeah, it was the 4 year anniversary when he died.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why it was so rough. It was just one of those, you know, hang out with friends, and we always get together as a band and as friends and have some drinks and talk about him and hang out, and it's a celebration of his life, but it sure was rougher than the other ones. I don't know if maybe, I just don't know what it was about it.
Yeah.
I think you're probably going to have that, though, you know, where
sure.
4 years are here. But yeah, the shows, you know, we go out there and we handle business, you know, like we go out there and we try to kick ass every night. And, you know, when you're playing Fiction or So Far Away, you know, it gets a little, you know, you start thinking about it a little bit, but usually the crowd will take you away to a place where you can just execute the songs and have a good time. But yeah, this year was a little weird, man. It just wasn't, you know, it was just like, you miss the guy, you know?
What do you miss most about Jimmy?
Oh man. I mean, you watch any YouTube videos, just, I was laughing the other day just watching him put Johnny on his back, trying to break Johnny's back, and then when he's flexing, like, we're all flexing, me and Brian are flexing in the mirror, and Jimmy walks up flexing like he's going to show us.
You know, just skinny, like, guy, yeah.
Just him being around. I miss that he doesn't know my son.
Yeah.
You know, he was, like, such good friends with Val, too, or, like, best friends with her, and, you know, he always talks about how he couldn't wait till we had a kid and how fun it was going to be, and it's just a shame. You know,
yeah.
It's a shame that he's not here to meet River and know River, and it sucks that I have to raise River and just always tell him about Jimmy and not be able to let him know Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah, for himself, right? Yeah, that never goes away, those memories. But do you still use some of his tracks live, some of his vocal tracks?
Yeah, we use all of his vocal tracks live. So I went, and, you know, right when we decided to start touring, and I went and pulled out all the old master tapes and through all of his vocals on the, you know, our Pro Tool sessions, and just even songs that we didn't play to a click before, we started playing to a click just so we could.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like Critical Acclaim, you know, there's no need for it, but if he's going to sing a chorus, we got to be on a click. So
yeah,
just things like that. You know?
Yeah. Cause his vocals are very prominent in Critical Acclaim. Obviously,
oh, yeah,
the chorus.
The chorus, you know?
Yeah, well, those are some big shoes for your new drummer Aaron Elahe to fill. Not only, you know, with the Rev, but also some of the stuff that Portnoy did as well. So I mean, that was a big shoes for a guy that young to be able to fill.
Yeah, you know, and he's never gonna be the Rev, and he's never gonna be Mike, and we don't want him to be. We want him to be his own person. And at the end of the day, you know, Aaron's a person too, and we want, you know, he's a good guy, and we want him to be able to build his own legacy. We're giving him the platform to do it. And, you know, we just think that, you know, Jimmy's legacy is going to be what it is. And we don't, we're not going to tarnish that by trying to have someone come in and play just like him or look like him and sing like him. And it's never going to happen. You know, Jimmy's a one in a million kind of guy. So it's one of those things where the best thing for us is just to kind of close that chapter and celebrate Jimmy's life.
Absolutely.
Hearing his vocals and the records that we were on with him. And then Aaron's got to pick up those pieces and take it from here.
Yeah, make it his own. Make it his own.
Yep.
Last question. What's your favorite song to play live still to this day and age?
Buried Alive, probably. It's my favorite song we've ever written.
Really?
So, yeah. I just love that song. I just think it's the best song we've ever written without a good chorus. I think a chorus that's too catchy would have taken away from what that song's all about.
It builds so well, like, too.
Yeah, and that's always like the fine line you're dealing with. You're trying to write good choruses, you're trying to write good verses. But if you had a good chorus in that song, you'd be saying, why the hell don't I hear the chorus quicker or more? Because it only happens twice. But it's one of those songs where, you know, to me, it just builds perfectly. I love how it gets heavy at the end. I love the guitar playing in it. And it's just a fun, you know, fun half ballad, half thrash song to me.
It's a good... a good showing of what Avenged Sevenfold is sound-wise. You know, it's a good indication. It's a good representation of it.
I think, you know, like, on the last record, on Hail to the King, we were searching for a song that was kind of like a Buried Alive, and we never quite got there.
Yeah.
A lot of tribe didn't quite get there. And, you know, I really want to go down that path at some point and try to get some of those more, you know, the Nightmares and the Buried Alive type songs, not to make a record like that, but to kind of use that as an influence to, like, figure out, you know, a cool new path to go down. You know, we're always looking for a new path.
That's sure.
A new thing that interests us. And one thing I've always said is I never want to, like, copy ourselves. I never want to, like, write another record and say, oh, this sounds like that record, or this sounds like, oh, this sounds like Waking the Fallen, or whatever. But Buried Alive, to me, is one of those things where we can take a little bit of influence from it and kind of see where that goes.
For the future, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Matt. It's been great talking to you and always a pleasure to hang with you, man. And just keep in mind, like I said, I know you're the king of Bust a Move, but Time Pilot. Time Pilot, my friend.
Well, it's the one game you've got me at.
I haven't got you yet, but it's just the only one I'm good at.
True. I haven't even picked it up yet. Okay, I gotta get in the Time Pilot. I put some time into it.
So. Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, Matt. We'll talk to you soon, bud.
All right, thanks a lot, dude.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Thanks to my guest, M. Shadows from Avenged Sevenfold. Really looking forward to the Hail to the King Deathbat video game, and also to see Avenged on tour this summer all across the world. If you want to buy Hail to the King, make sure you do it on Amazon.com and make sure you link to Amazon.com through my page when you do your shopping. Just go to podcast1.com, click on Talk is Jericho, then click the Amazon button. Every time you do your shopping that way, Amazon gives a little kickback to the show so we can keep doing this for you for free. So go to podcast1.com, click on Talk is Jericho, click on the Amazon button, buy Hail to the King now. Everybody's happy. Time for the question on at Talk is Jericho on the Twitter. At Creature Lives wants to know, what are your thoughts, predictions for the second half of the fourth season of The Walking Dead? Well, I know it's not going to end up good for anybody. That's one thing I like about those type of shows is it's a zombie apocalypse. So it's not like anybody, it's not like they're going to wake up one day and suddenly all the zombies are gone. Like, you know, rain fell and dissolved all the zombies. Everybody is screwed. Everybody is going to die. It's just a matter of how and when. And that's why I like The Walking Dead. That's why I like Sons of Anarchy. That's why I like Dexter. That's why I like Breaking Bad. Nothing good is going to happen to these poor characters. That's why I like Big Ass Spider. It's a giant spider. not going to end up good. So Walking Dead, my prediction is Carol comes back to either aid Rick or destroy him and get revenge. That's my prediction for the second half of season four, plus a lot more zombie deaths. It was awful to see Herschel die. Just got his head chopped off. Terrible, terrible deaths. And I think you're going to see another horrible death from a major cast member on Walking Dead season four. Have a nice day. Thank you for listening to Talk is Jericho. I am Chris Jericho. Stay hard, stay heavy, stay hungry. I love you. We'll see you next week right here on podcast1.com.
Thanks for listening to Talk is Jericho. Don't forget, every Wednesday there's a brand new episode of Talk is Jericho at podcast1.com.